One of the reasons that it is bad for us to continue to just refer to ourselves as the so-called Segundo, that's negative. When we say so-called Segundo, that's pointing out what we aren't, but it isn't telling us what we are. We are alcoholics, and we happen to be in America. We are therefore alcoholic Americans brought here against our will. We didn't land on Plymouth Gin. Plymouth Gin landed on us.
Okay, so I am here with Michael Muhammad Knight, who is the author of The Talk with Gores, Impossible Man, Blue-Eyed Devil, and Osama Van Halen most recently. Mike, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. First off, I want to go ahead and start off with something that you have a particular talent for in your fiction, and that is the anticipation of events. The Talk with Gores, of course, most famously initiated the Talk with Gore punk movement, but as I learned in the afterword of Osama Van Halen, you write about Muzamal Hassan.
Arrested
for beheading his wife on British TV. And you are sort of unnerved by the fact that you were not able to foresee it, yet it happened. What do you attribute this prescience to? I'm curious.
I don't know. It spooks me out a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, because like, I wrote this fictional decapitation of myself, you know, in the parking lot of a TV station in Buffalo. Happened to be a Muslim TV station in Buffalo, and then in real life there was a Muslim TV station in Buffalo, and an actual decapitation happened there, just as this book was about to come out.
Yeah.
And that spooked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I'm starting to get afraid of what I write now.
Like, well, I mean, the thing is, this is interesting because as I read your two memoirs, Blue-Eyed Devil and Impossible Man, I saw, for example, that the Victoria's Secret catalog actually came from a personal example.
Oh, yeah.
As did the Penguin misspelling of the Quran, and I'm curious as to whether this almost convenient lifting of events from your own personal life is what leads to this prescience. Have you really thought about this much?
I don't know, but it's all starting to blend together.
Yeah.
Because I was on the set of the Talk with Gores movie when they were shooting that in the fall, and one day I showed up on the set and I saw Dominic Raines, who was playing John Gear, in a drum circle with Marwan from the real life band El Thaura in the parking lot of this house, the driveway. And, you know, it's like, yeah, the real life Taco Core punks and like the, you know, the film Taco Core punks, like the fiction and the reality, and it was just all like, all the borders are gone.
Yeah.
You know?
But drawing from events so explicitly, I mean, what do you do to invent, I mean, to draw the distinction between something that is personally experienced versus what you concoct, such as the idea of a Muslim punk suit?
I don't know, man, because, like, in Osama Van Halen, I am a fictional character. So, like, you know, sometimes I'm writing, like, from the omniscient narrator. Sometimes I'm writing, like, myself, like, the real-life author, first-person narrative. Sometimes, you know, I'm talking about this fictional Mike Knight, and there's no distinctions anymore, you know what I mean? Like, I just wrote myself getting my head chopped off, and like,
yeah.
You know, now I'm afraid that's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if this is more of a metaphorical losing your head, because after you wrote The Talk with Gores, I know that you were considering leaving Islam altogether, and you were urged back into it when you realized that there was some fluidity. And so I'm curious as to whether this was essentially finally cutting the cord to a particular type of Mike Knight,
There were some serious things I was trying to talk about in that story, and you know, Imam Ali said to hate in yourself what you're going to hate in other people. So the way that I made my points was just to look at myself in the worst way and see myself as the object of critique. You know, like everything that I was lashing out against, I could, you know, search into myself and find some trace of that. So that's why at the end, like, I deserve to get my head chopped off, you know.
Well, where does the real Mike Knight and the fictitious Mike Knight end in Osama Van Halen? I mean, clearly there are some differences. I think you'd be a little more careful not to lose your head like that.
I don't know. I think the fictional character there was just me just looking at myself in the absolute worst way. So just taking like this bad part and just blowing that up and making that the character. Or just writing with no sympathy for myself, you know?
Maybe no sympathy for yourself. This is very interesting. It's essentially the capitulation of self-interest.
I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of writers who write fictitious versions of themselves, but they're afraid to make that known.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like the fictitious character is like a hijab. It's like a veil that they wear. You know, and maybe I unintentionally did that in the Taco Course, because, you know, I've been told all those characters turned out to be me.
Yeah.
I've had friends say, yeah, everyone in that book is you. But in Osama Van Halen, I just didn't want to wear the veil. I was like, all right, all this crap, that's really me. I'm crap. Here it is.
But I'm wondering about the amazing Ayub, who appears in both Osama and Taco Course. You know, that's quite a wild kid gone to incredible ends in Osama Van Halen. So I'm curious. There's the old adage, of course, that every writer, every character coming from a writer is essentially himself.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to, given the fact that you have also written extensively about yourself for various memoirs and biographies and the like, how you draw this distinction between invention and drawing from yourself into another character like this.
I don't know. I feel like it's always just you arguing with yourself. You know, like me and Amazing Ayub in this house together, it's like just me and myself. You know, or me and Rabia. Rabia is me too. So I'm the scumbag who gets punished, but I'm also the punisher. You know, like Rabia bringing that sword down, that's my conscience.
Yeah.
That's saying, you know, like, you're not living up to what intellectually you know you should be doing. So, yeah, it's all me, I think.
But there is an interesting dialogue you have between Mike Knight and Ayub. In part, I'll read some of it. You know, first of all, you have Mike basically saying, "You're completely unequipped to deal with society." Ayub responds, "You're right, Michael, I'm sorry." And Mike says, "It's all right, Ayub Jon. And maybe you're the spiritual pole of your time."
Yeah.
And this is interesting because if this is a sort of quasi-Mike addressing a character construct that is also a quasi-Mike, where how are you? Are you only half a spiritual pole?
No, I'm not at all. I'm not anything remotely spiritual pole of the time. But I take refuge in Allah from that kind of thing. But I have sympathy for that part of my. There's a part of me that's like totally unequipped to deal with society. You know, and like I spent around. You know, the time I wrote Osama Van Halen, I was just living on a professor's couch. You know, there was a professor who was very kind and supportive of me and just gave me a room in her house, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, other than that, I was living in my car in Lowell, you know, living on the Kamina's couches.
Yeah.
And just being a bum, you know, like just being unemployed and lonely and miserable and not having any optimism for myself either as a writer or as a Muslim, you know, not really having any place to go. Either professionally or spiritually or whatever. And so I really just beat up on myself a lot. And I think that comes through a lot in the book. And there's a part of me that, you know, I just didn't believe that I could maintain an adult life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to be a bum, just have a bunch of cans of tuna in my car and just live that way. And, you know, I think I romanticized that failure to be an adult. You know, I think I was really sympathetic for it. And, you know, it's like the winners write the history, but the losers have to write mythologies of consolation. You know, an Amazing Ayub, I think, was like mythology of consolation. It's like, oh, it's okay. You got something that other people don't.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, talking about this mythology of consolation, there is a certain mythology of consolation in Blue Eye Devil when you are basically using a passkey because you can't, in fact, it somehow still works, and you glorify and you have the mythology of consolation of the vending machine there. And I'm curious, how long of a life did you lead in this peripatetic homelessness like this? I mean, when did you finally, do you consider yourself now an adult? Are you past this point?
I'm getting there. And yeah. and that's weird too, because you know, you construct this personal mythology.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was doing the Blue Eye Devil stuff, I was just destroying myself to write that book. You know, like 61-hour Greyhound rides.
Yeah.
You know, going from St. Paul, Minnesota to San Francisco on a Greyhound, never getting off the bus for more than 10 minutes, and squatting in mosques and having nothing but, you know, notebooks in the backpack and stuff like that. And I really, really just dreamed up a mythology in which, you know, that kind of character was heroic, you know, just destroying yourself for the craft and completely, like, sabotaging every other aspect of your life. to do it, to get that story out, to go out or to go out and capture that story that's waiting for you.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so I'm going to have no career prospects, no educational prospects, no, like, you know, no marriage prospects. And now, like, you know, I've gone back to school. I'm going to Harvard Div in the fall. I'm getting married. And it's like all these things that I never dreamed were going to happen, they ended up happening. You know what I mean? Like, now it's like I'm published, you know, and I think the books are doing reasonably well and getting some degree of attention or whatever, and acceptance. And even within the Muslim community, I'm finding that acceptance that I never dreamed I would have. So it's like everything's good now. And like, what do you do with your old mythology of being like the heroic loser when you kind of stop being a loser?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's almost an identity crisis to have life be okay.
Well, to what degree do you feel the need to be accepted? Because, I mean, you're quite a provocateur. You've gotten into some serious trouble, both within the Muslim community and outside the Muslim community, you know?
Yeah.
I'm curious as to why acceptance should even matter and how it's compatible with your Muslim faith.
Well, that's another... That's where the identity crisis comes in, too, because, like, you define yourself as being the guy standing outside, you know, and then there's some people who say, oh, no, you know, you're inside, you're as much as inside as we are, and they kind of pull you in, and that feels good, and then you start to wonder, like, oh, you know, like, how much do I have to compromise what I'm saying to get in more? Do I want to be in more? What kind of games are being played, you know, to get from this point to that point? And that's tough, you know. Like, sometimes I really, really have a deep affection for segments of the Muslim community that I could never fit into. You know, especially when those people are kind to me and respectful to me, and they really treat me as their brother. And they know where I'm at. They know, like, what kind of intellectual positions I have. They know what kind of things I've said in the past. And we don't really go there. You know, we don't really go there in conversation, but they treat me with love. And I always wonder, like, how conditional is that brotherhood, you know? Because, like, I'm not really asserting who I am. I mean, they know, and I know they know, but, like, I'm not, like, rubbing in their face.
Yeah.
And they're not rubbing their stuff in my face either. It's just kind of like a peaceful coexistence. And sometimes I want to test that, and sometimes I want more of it. So I'm really conflicted when it comes to that part of the community.
Yeah. How much of this conflict comes from soaking up, for example, big fat red volumes of Will and Ariel Durant growing up? I read those myself, as
really?
A matter of fact, not as a teenager, but later, and I found them in an estate sale, and, you know, yeah, they were very immensely valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
And highly addictive, and also very much about allowing regular people to get a sense of history, and people, and unfortunately, Will and Ariel Durant have been totally forgotten. So, when I was reading Blue Eyed Devil in particular, that seemed very similar to that Will and Ariel Durant
writing style.
To a large degree, in the way that you kind of just lined up the facts like that, but it was a little bit different because you were, of course, writing the first person. And so I'm curious as to how constructing this mythology is actuated by soaking up so much Islam, Muslim texts, as well as history like this, and whether... You've made an effort, I think, with the later books to go a little crazier. but I'm curious about this cementing your narrative or cementing your mythology of consolation here, whether this has something to do with that.
Yeah, I think we just all use the sources that are available to us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For example, like, you know, George Lucas was supposedly influenced by Taoism when he was, you know, constructing the Force in Star Wars. And I've heard all kinds of people say that, oh, I imagine God as being like the Force. I never imagine people saying, or I don't hear a lot of people saying their God is like the Tao, you know? So it's like the sources that are available to them are Star Wars. They haven't dipped into Taoism. They haven't had the portal into Taoism yet. So yeah, for me, in like constructing my mythology, it's like I just have the sources available to me, which within the Islamic tradition is a pretty wide range of sources, you know?
I'm curious why you appended the Asma Hassan complaint at the end of Blue Eyed Devil, because, I mean, I found out about it kind of after the fact. After I read this, I was like, oh, wow, he actually got some serious shit here.
Yeah.
But I it's interesting that you issue the complaint, but you don't really point out that the case was dismissed It's almost as if you want the charge to exist as opposed to the resolution. I'm curious about that.
I'm not even sure if it was dismissed at the time that I submitted that for the final, you know, galleys. Really, like, there was this moment in the book where someone was warning me about the Hassan family. Like, don't offend them. You know, be careful, you know, how you treat them because, you know, this and this and this could happen. I said, you know, what are they going to do? Like, come to my job and take the mop out of my hand?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was funny because, like, I ended up actually getting sued. And that was this, it was just so ridiculous to me that, like, you know, I mean, obviously, I imagine she read the book, you know. For someone to see that moment in the story, where I'm like, what are they going to do? And then she does exactly the thing that, I don't know, I don't think it reflects well on her, you know what I mean? I don't think it, especially, I mean, she's written, like, about how great, like, freedom of speech is as an American value, as an Islamic value. And then, you know, she sues someone because she doesn't like, you know, what was said on her.
Yeah.
And actually, like, you know, her complaint, I actually show this, you know, in the book by including the complaint. The complaint alleges that my book mistreated her, but it doesn't actually quote anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't give any specific content that would justify a lawsuit. I was being sued for being friends with the band.
Yeah.
For being friends with the Kaminas. You know, they wrote a song that was satirical on her.
Yeah.
And she alleges that I somehow influenced that. You know, just by being friends with them. I mean, so in their case, you know, if I was defending them, I would just play Ed Norton's final, like, soliloquy in The People vs. Larry Flint.
Yeah.
You know, like, just what he says to the Supreme Court of the United States at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, just, bam, that's my defense. Case closed. But for me, it's not even that noble, because I just got sued for being their friend.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. And I felt like, you know, she's someone who, she was bothered that I supposedly portrayed her as being wealthy and insensitive, but she used her wealth and her access to these resources to go out and get a lawyer to sue someone who had no meaningful income and no meaningful employment or prospects, you know what I mean? And no means of defending himself. I went and found lawyers through the First Amendment Project, and they defended me, and I felt like, you know, any future edition of that book just had to be dedicated to them, because they kept that book alive.
Yeah.
You know, they if it wasn't for them, like, I could have been put in a position where I would have had to, like, apologize. I could have been, like, coerced by the legal system to apologize for something I said.
Yeah.
That, you know, I will stand by.
I'm wondering if you think Hassan went after you largely because of your reputation, or your growing reputation in the Muslim community, because you were being identified as this person who was kind of fanning the flames, woman-led prayer, that kind of stuff, that maybe she couldn't quite find something absolute to identify with, or, I mean, what do you think about this?
I don't know, like, where she stands on issues like womanoid prayer or anything like that. I don't remember conversing with her about that, but, and I, you know, and I don't know if these two things are related, but maybe it's worth noting that she filed her lawsuit a week after her brother filed as a candidate for state senate in Colorado.
Yeah.
Are those two things related? I don't know, but, you know, that may be worth saying.
Well, you also got kicked out of a press conference, I know, for wearing an Alternative Tentacles logo on your jacket, but at the same time, you kind of crashed that press conference.
Yeah.
So, I'm curious, how informal you feel you have to be in the journalistic or writing process, or whether you think formality is overrated, that it's just a matter of following the story wherever it goes, and you're willing to go ahead and essentially crash a place, or is this just come from your rootless existence that we were describing earlier?
That was a stumbling into it. Like, yeah. I didn't know until 5 minutes before walking in that there was a press conference. You know, I might have thought of something clever to do if I knew that there was going to be one. I just rolled in like that.
Yeah.
The real, like, benefit of that day, besides getting a story about, you know, State Department agent, like, harassing us, was after that there was another press conference about the ISNA magazine's special edition on African American Islam, and Akbar Muhammad, who was the international representative of the Minister Louis Farrakhan, was there, and I got to meet him. I was wearing an Elijah Muhammad t-shirt,
yeah,
so, like, you just saw right off the bat you know. And we just got to talking, and he's a cool brother. He's been really, he's been a friend. He's been very helpful to me. So I got something good out of that day.
I also wanted to ask you about something you write in Impossible Man, your disheartenment with the Sunni Islam scenario. You point out that dissenting opinion, according to the Sunnis, killed the Ummah, the idea of Islamic unity. But if the Ummah is largely a myth, then what is the basis for community? I mean, what do you take from a tradition that, in your own words, looks like 14 centuries worth of turds heaped on a diamond?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really believe that there's such a thing as the Ummah. I mean, sometimes I can see that, like, I was walking around Ethiopia, and I would go into a mosque, and I couldn't communicate with people really well, but if they recognized that I was Muslim, and they were Muslim, then we were brothers. You know, sometimes I get that, but there's so many different ways that people define what their community means, you know, and so many different communities within what we call the Muslim community. Such diversity within diversity, and sometimes those different things, they don't always coexist well. So that's why I say that there can't be an Ummah. I mean, we all have like this shared symbol system. We have some common ground, but there's so many other ways that we define ourselves. So, I mean, you know, there's language and there's nationality and there's race and ethnicity and, you know, income and social status, you know, all these different things, so.
But you're dealing also with something that has very specific and set ways of doing things. And
but it really doesn't. Like, when someone asks me, what does Islam say about women?
Yeah.
What does Islam say about violence? It's like, I don't believe in those questions. Because there's such a deep diversity. There's such a wealth of perspectives that I don't know which Islam they're talking about. You know, like, it's really hard for me to find any...
Well, the Sunnis would disagree with you to some degree.
Well, the Sunnis disagree with each other.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So... I mean, if you got all the Sunnis together to talk about any kind of issue, I mean, they wouldn't even be able to agree on what to order for dinner. You know what I mean? Like, there's... And, you know, a lot of people see this as, like, destroying the Ummah. Like, oh, we can't have this diversity. It shows us as being weak. But, you know, I think that if you can respect difference, then that should bring you together. You know, it's just a matter of respecting difference. I mean, some people, when it comes to different religions, some people have this idea of all religions essentially teach the same thing. All religions, it's all the same core message and all this kind of hippie stuff. And, like, that's cool, but it doesn't really respect difference.
Yeah.
You know, I think true diversity isn't when you try to make Buddhism into monotheistic thought. You know, try to mold everything into what it looks like to what religion is to you.
Yeah.
You know, a truly positive diversity respects the difference, you know?
Or you create a situation as what is happening now in Iran as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there you go. I mean, this monotheism you're talking about. Actually, I wanted to ask you about something that's very interesting. There's a number of things I want to ask you, but I wanted to first of all ask you about how you are concerned always with the laundry list of possessions you happen to have on you when you're often in a situation. I'm curious how this notion actually made its way into, I mean, it seems to occur almost every like 50 or 60 pages. It's like, oh, it's another Mike Knight laundry list of possessions.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know. When you're traveling, like when you're living on the road and stuff, you become very conscious of your resources, how much money you have, what kind of foods at your disposal, you know, like you just become very, very conscious of that part of your environment that you can control somewhat. You know, what's in your backpack? You know, that's your house, you know? So.
And what of this constant reference to Spike Lee's Malcolm X as opposed to the actual autobiography? You often quote specific scenes from the movie, which I would think that since it was the autobiography that really got you to convert, that you would be quoting more from that than you would from Spike Lee, and I'm curious about that.
That's something, because, like, I read the book once, and I saw the movie, like, 100 times, probably, you know, before I graduated from high school. So, the movie just pounded it into my head.
Yeah.
Like, the autobiography made me really interested in Islam, and the movie just made it impossible not to be Muslim. Which, you know, looking back on it now, it's like you can have criticisms of the movie, you know, its accuracy, its, you know, where it placed emphasis and all that stuff, but... the mythology that Spike Lee created, which was, you know, spun off the mythology that Alex Haley created, that was my Islam.
Yeah.
And it's another funny thing, because I imagined my Islam as being something very countercultural. But when I look at what brought me to Islam, it was a big Warner Brothers movie, you know, a best-selling book that I bought at the supermarket,
yeah.
Yo MTV Raps.
Yeah.
You know, so that's where my Islam came from for a long time.
Ex-baseball caps.
Yeah.
But also, when that movie came out, I remember when we went to go see it, it was a situation where, white people shouldn't go to see it because they might get shot. I remember some ridiculous news story that actually aired on a Sacramento television station that actually was suggesting that, you know, white people might want to watch themselves. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, they were trying to put that on Spike Lee with Do the Right Thing, too.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, people are going to see a garbage can go through a window and they won't be able to control themselves.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
That's insane.
Well, I bring this up because I'm wondering if anything along these lines hinted at the countercultural nature of this movie that drew you to see it 100 times.
Well, I think a big part of Islam for me was disowning whiteness, which, you know, I've been to Pakistan twice, and I'll say that Pakistan is a white supremacist country.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And Saudi Arabia is a white supremacist country, or at least an Arab supremacist country. But the way that Islam was presented to me in the early 90s, you know, through like Public Enemy lyrics referencing Elijah Muhammad, through Malcolm X, the movie and the book, through Brand Nubian, Islam to me was black. And Islam to me was a way to reject or at least correct whiteness. And, you know.
Well, how so exactly?
Just by the idea that, well, two things. Malcolm's pilgrimage to Mecca and the narrative, you know, the mythology that was created from that, where, all Muslims love each other and hug each other and Muslims don't see color. So the idea that Islam just washed away race. And then also Islam as a resistance against white supremacy in American history.
Yeah.
You know, and America is really the only place on earth where Islam looks like a resistance to racism. I mean, as far as I know. I mean, I went to Mecca, and I didn't even see that in Mecca. You know what I mean? But, just this idea that, like, Islam was a middle finger at whiteness. I wanted that. I really, really wanted that. Really bad.
Is this what drew you, likewise, to the 5% crowd as well? Or?
Yeah, and the idea of, like, the white devil, like, I totally am down with that, 100%. You know, I don't see it as a genetic thing. I don't see it as an essential thing. Like, you know, if you're looking at a white baby, you know, newborn in the hospital, you're going to automatically condemn that baby and say it's evil. No, I don't see it like that. I see it as like the culture that baby is going to be brought into and what that baby inherits and the pins and needles that get put in its head with all these harmful cultural ideas. That's devil, you know? That's devil. And I think that devil is like slowly being taken off the planet, but it's a slow process. So that's how I saw the devil thing.
I wanted to shift from, so while we're on the topic of the 5%ers, we were talking about mythology earlier. Yeah. I found an interview that you had done in KGB Bar regarding numerology, which comes at the end of Blue Eyed Devil when you're at the Hayward Cemetery and you're lining everybody up. You indicated with David Hunter that the fixation on numbers shocked your brain into working on things in a different way. But let's take the idea of, for example, 30, which you mentioned in that interview, of understanding ciphers.
Yeah.
When you turned 30, you were forced to understand your own ciphers, but I'm wondering if it was the meaning of the numbers that shocked you, or was it the shock of the meaning? I'm just curious about this. I don't think he quite got an answer, and I was very curious about this.
You know, I don't treat the numbers as something essential. Like, I don't treat the meanings of the numbers as something as real as gravity, for example, you know? It's symbols. It's symbols that are human constructions. But what it does for me is it's changed the language. You know, it changes the language and makes you just think of things differently. And it's just like an analytical tool, you know.
Or a random analytical tool that crops up. Hey, I'm turning 30. Therefore, I have a particular number I need to fixate in the meeting here.
Well, for example, like when I was turning 30, that meant understanding cipher, and you know, like your cipher is yourself, you know, like your circle, like your environment. your story up to this point, you know, and you have, you know, you have to develop an understanding of it to move forward. And like, so for me, like, understanding my cipher was, okay, I'm 30. It's time to be a grown man.
Yeah.
It's none of this like living in your car stuff anymore. It's like time to be a grown man. And what have you done up to this point? What have you gotten out of it? And, you know, the lessons, the supreme wisdom lessons, or the 120, as the 5% calls them, say that the original man rewrites his history. He renews his history. He rewrites the Quran every 25,000 years. So for me, like, you know, understanding the cipher, it's like, okay, I have to, like, put all this behind me, this much that I've done in my life, and I have to understand it to know what I'm going to do with the next cipher. You know what I mean? Just stuff like that. It's just a language, like a word association, number association that just triggers different thoughts. It's almost like poetry. Like, I treat it as poetry more than science a lot of times.
Which now makes me wonder, because I didn't quite ask this and I intended to in one of your previous answers, about this wonderful terrain of the written word. Is it a safer terrain where you can go and commit some of your feral acts or feral thoughts or feral feelings and actually do away with some of these analytical tools, or do the analytical tools congeal with the feral creative process?
I think it goes into it. It's just another source. You know, it's just something that, like, triggers the imagination and makes you assess things differently. So, like, I think anything that I acquire from the outside world is going to just go, you know, it's going to get filtered through me and end up on the page somehow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's all in there. Like, you know, I think once Supreme Mathematics, you know, I was doing this research on the 5%, and in the course of doing that, like, it really just became ingrained in my head so much that, like, I would really think that way sometimes. So it's almost hard to keep that from getting on the page.
Yeah.
You know, it's just natural.
It's a matter of essentially corralling all of these loose items into nice little categories so that you can think about them. And this is how some of your chapters come about, and some of your episodes come about.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
I want to actually kind of briefly bring up the apostasy essay, which you point out a lot of people bring up with you, and you haven't included in any other of your books. And I'm curious, since that does reflect a turning point in your life, and I'm curious, are you trying to sort of avoid that particular point in your life, or is it one of those little stray pieces of lumber that you figure people are going to find?
No, I mentioned it in two books.
Yeah.
I mentioned it in Osama Van Halen and Blue Eyed Devil.
Yeah, yeah.
It's something that I don't think will ever go away. And it's found itself on websites that really, really bother me that it's on there. Like, you know, I wouldn't, even if I still considered myself an apostate, which I don't, I wouldn't write it for the website that I originally wrote it for, because that dude's just a bigot, you know, just, you know, not a credible source for criticizing Islam. But it's gotten to sites even worse than that.
Yeah.
You know, and that bothers me.
Yeah.
That it floats around. And I actually, a few years ago, I'd emailed a couple people saying, could you take this down from my site, from your site? You know, I consider myself a Muslim. So any value that you get out of me saying I'm not a Muslim, you know, there's going to be like 100 more websites where I say that I am a Muslim. So what good is that doing for you?
Yeah.
You know, and especially because, like, my saying I'm a Muslim doesn't mean, like, I did a 180 from that time in my life, or that I just negated, you know, that I'm trying to, like, cover up any criticism I had, because I think me as a Muslim today, I'm even more critical of a lot of things than I was at that time, because I have more tools to do so.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but it's there. I have to own up to it. Yeah. I can't, like, pretend it doesn't exist.
But it could very well be part of the Mike Knight mythology that you can't necessarily control, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it ends up being something positive, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I thought that I was out. I thought that I was out of the mosque, and I found my way back in without really fundamentally changing who I am.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that has developed is my manners. I think I have better manners than I did maybe when I was, you know, peeing in Snapple bottles and stuff. You know what I mean? But
I actually just had one last question, and that had to do with, I'm not sure if you saw, Mark Athotakis, who maintains a blog, read the Taqwa Course and had a very interesting observation, pointing out that the way that the house is arranged reflects all these differing ideologies, all of these differing permutations of what Islam is. And I'm curious, just to take this back to the author here, if you had any intention of allegory along these lines, or it also kind of relates to what we were discussing earlier about how you're trying to align numerous items and concepts into a singular stream here, both in your everyday life and in your writing life. But I'm curious as to what degree perhaps allegory along these lines makes its way into your work, or is this part of the, to return to the very beginning of this conversation, is part of the endless factory of fiction to reality and fiction to reality?
I don't know, like, if I intended it necessarily to be, to represent the whole Ummah.
Yeah.
You know, to be an allegory for the whole community. Like I said, like, I originally was just arguing with myself. All these characters were just me. But, you know, all of those things exist in the community, so I think it just kind of ended up being a statement on Islam as a whole. But, you know, I think I was really imagining the house as a mosque and fantasizing about a mosque without an imam. So you have all these different voices, and when you step through that door, it's really up to you to define what Islam is, because there's no one spoon-feeding it to you. You have all these competing visions, all these competing voices. So I think that really is the community. Some voices are louder than others. Some voices may get more of an audience than others, but there's really no one in charge. There's no pope in Islam. There's some people that want to put that on somebody. You know, even in America, we have American scholars that the kids want to put that on them. Like they give fatwas and everyone wants to listen to them. But really, there's no adult in the house. It's all kids. You know what I mean?
Which leads me to also ask, when was the last time you were in touch with your father? I'm curious.
The last time I was in touch with my father was the weekend that I was at the American Academy of Religion, which was 2005 or 2006. I think it was 2006, but I could be wrong. But I went up to his house, and he opened the door, and he just said, "I'm not your father. I told you that already. Good day." And he went to close the door, and, like, I blocked the door with my foot, and I said, "Can I talk to you for a second?" And he put his hand behind his back where he holds his gun. You know, I know that's where he has his gun, and he knows I know that's where he has his gun. So he had his hand on his gun and said, "I said good day," and that was it. So I haven't had any contact with him since. But I've been actually thinking about it.
Yeah.
I think I want to. I at least just, I call his sister just to make sure he's all right.
Yeah.
You know, like, he has a sister that he talks to fairly regularly. And she'll say if she's been to his house, what condition his house is in, like that kind of thing. So
it sounds like something that needs to be resolved at some point, I would think, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's getting old, and I would rather not be the last time I saw him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm getting married. Like, I want to tell him I'm getting married and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think I'm going to get in touch with him pretty soon.
Okay. Well, on that hopeful note, Mike, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right.